This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Compared to presidents and legislators, the justices of the Supreme Court are beholden to no one. Concerned only with the law, with the Constitution, they pretend to sit majestically, serenely beyond grubby politics. They have no campaigns to finance, no higher positions to angle for. This is the source of their integrity, or at least that's the theory. But the cascade of revelations coming out about Justice Clarence Thomas suggests something else, something far less high-flown. There's the glitzy vacations and the island-hopping yachting adventures underwritten by a right-wing billionaire patron. There's the undisclosed real estate deals. And then there's Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas, and her ties, financial and political, to various conservative groups, as well as her full-throated support of Donald Trump and the attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election. There are perhaps precedents for this kind of thing, but Thomas seems to have taken matters to the next level. The New Yorker's Jane Mayer co-wrote the book Strange Justice about Clarence Thomas almost 30 years ago. Last year, she reported on Ginny Thomas's influence in Washington. And now Jane is working on a book about the conservative movement to control the courts. Jane, you've been covering Clarence Thomas for a very long time, right from the beginning. What stands out to you from these revelations that were first published in ProPublica?
I suppose one of the things that amazed me about the ProPublica story, which was really rigorously reported, was the extent to which Clarence Thomas has been a repeat and kind of chronic offender when it comes to making public disclosures that Supreme Court justices are supposed to make about their finances. This isn't the first time. This has been going on for years. It's just maybe the most egregious examples of it.
Well, what's the history? Let's go back and go through it.
Well, if you go back to 2004, the Los Angeles Times wrote a story at that point, saying that Clarence Thomas had taken a couple of very expensive gifts from a billionaire from Texas named Harlan Crow, whose family fortune was made in the real estate business. And Harlan Crow had sort of, for reasons unknown, given Clarence Thomas an original Bible that had been owned by the abolitionist Frederick Douglass, which was worth $19,000, and had also given to Clarence Thomas, who was on the Supreme Court back in 2004, a $15,000 bust of Abraham Lincoln. And the LA Times reached out to Harlan Crow and asked, what is this about? And he said, well, I really like Clarence Thomas, and I knew he liked Frederick Douglass, and I saw this in an auction catalog, and just gave it to him. And that was the last time that Clarence Thomas disclosed private travel, including at that time, he disclosed that Harlan Crow had paid for his travel to a kind of a very shishy exclusive men's gathering called Bohemian Grove.
Oh, where they all get together and they pee on the lawn and they have a very great time. So
that is what's always said.
So but what, anyway, what are the ethical considerations here? What are the guidelines that are set down by the Supreme Court? And in what way was, even in 2004, was Clarence Thomas in violation of them, if he indeed was?
Well, what was interesting was in 2004, he actually was complying with the regulations which require disclosure, but then there was bad publicity that came out of it, and he stopped complying.
So if you report it, there's nothing wrong with it?
Well, up to a point. The rules for Supreme Court justices when it comes to financial disclosures are very lax, but there are a few categories of financial disclosures that have to be made publicly. And they include real estate transactions and gifts. But if a justice can say that the gifts fall under the category of personal hospitality from a friend, then they don't need to be disclosed. And so basically it's been understood by over the years to mean, you know, if you go to a friend's house for dinner,
right, they give you a lamb chop and a salad. That's nice. But
right,
a yachting vacation in Indonesia. That's more
exactly
complicated.
So it should have been disclosed. And are there things that even Supreme Court justices are not just supposed to disclose, but also not to take? Well, yes, there are. There is actually a law that applies to all judges, including Supreme Court justices, that says that they are not supposed to preside over a case in which a family member has some kind of interest in the outcome. And they're certainly not supposed to take gifts from people who have cases in front of them.
In 2011, it came to light that Thomas hadn't disclosed hundreds of thousands of dollars, more than $500,000, that his wife Ginny Thomas had earned from the Heritage Foundation. That's quite a substantial amount of money. Did that trespass any ethics violations?
Yes. Yes. Again, that's why he is a chronic offender on this subject. He was supposed to have disclosed a spouse's income. And he said, he just had misunderstood the filing requirements. And he amended his filings to reflect that she had earned, I think it was between $600,000 and $700,000 over the years from the Heritage Foundation, which is an organization, a conservative think tank, that has very distinct legal issues and a legal agenda that it promotes through cases in the Supreme Court.
Does Harlan Crow have any cases that are either in front of the Supreme Court, were in front of the Supreme Court, or potentially in front of the Supreme Court?
He has said he does. He has no cases that have been in front of Clarence Thomas, and Clarence Thomas has said the same. And so they have said that this is just a friendship, and what's wrong with that?
Well, I ask you that question. What's the fuss?
It's a lot of money from one benefactor. If you step back, basically, what are judges supposed to be? They're supposed to be honest. They're supposed to be independent. And I think it sort of stretches common sense to think that a judge could be independent when he takes that much money from one person. I mean, and what are we talking about here? Maybe millions of dollars worth of gifts and travel and vacations from Harlan Crow.
Is there any history to this in the Supreme Court? Have other justices, liberal, conservative, or centrist, that we know of, taken gifts like this?
Well, first of all, the problem is you don't know what you don't know as a reporter, right? If these things
right.
are undisclosed. But there's certainly other justices who have taken sort of lavish trips that are paid for by others. Maybe not as, I don't think anything anywhere near as lavish as this Indonesian trip, or as regular as going every summer, as Clarence Thomas appears to have done, to an estate that Harlan Crow has up in the Adirondacks. But there are other justices who certainly have gone on junkets that are paid for by others. And I think that they are justices both of the liberal persuasion and of the conservative ones.
Mike, for example, in 2018, Ruth Bader Ginsburg got a private tour of Israel that was paid for by an Israeli billionaire named Morris Kahn. who has had business before the court. I don't remember there being a giant fuss about that.
Well, maybe there should have been. I mean, I mean, personally, yeah. I feel like all of this is very troubling. And I think that we know from when Antonin Scalia died that he died at a hunting ranch, basically, that was privately owned and on a trip that was undisclosed. We wouldn't have known about it except for the fact that that he suddenly and unexpectedly died there. And it turned out he had taken oodles of similar hunting trips over the years that were paid for by private individuals.
How different is this from members of the executive branch, White House staff, presidents themselves, and members of Congress?
There are far fewer disclosure requirements for the Supreme Court than for those in any other branch of the government. And the other problem is really that unlike the other branches of the government, there's no enforcement mechanism for the Supreme Court. So it's basically the honor system. And there's no way to deal with violations, really, which is why we're in this situation here with Clarence Thomas. You know, how do you deal with this at this point? There's no inspector general at the Supreme Court. There's no ethics advisor at the Supreme Court. It is just the justices are trusted to do the right thing.
Now, the question arises, what's to be done about this? One of the most vocal proponents of ethics reform at the court, that's been going on for years, has been Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who I know you've talked to any number of times. He's calling for Justice Thomas to be referred to the Attorney General for potential violations of government ethics laws. And on Tuesday, we heard the allegations are now with a judicial committee that could, at least in theory, make that referral. So explain what this committee is and how this could all work. What's ahead for Justice Thomas?
So there is an organization called the U.S. Judicial Conference, which basically administers the courts. And it is the body that sort of sets the requirements for things such as these disclosures. It interprets the Ethics in Government Act and oversees its administration for the courts. And so what's happened here is congressional Democrats and several watchdog groups have demanded that the U.S. Judicial Conference open an investigation into Clarence Thomas, looking into his lack of disclosures, and that if they find that these omissions were willful, that they then make a recommendation to the Justice Department that it open an investigation into Clarence Thomas.
And where could that lead?
it could lead to a fine. It could lead to civil charges. It could even lead to criminal charges, all depending on what the circumstances are. I would say it's very far-fetched to imagine that this would lead to criminal charges. But what it would also lead to potentially is just a widening scandal here that will create pressure, increased pressure on Clarence Thomas and on Chief Justice John Roberts to do something.
Well, right. You raise John Roberts, Chief Justice, and if I'm watching MSNBC, I'm hearing a lot of people say Justice Roberts must do something. If I'm watching, of course, Fox, I'm hearing a lot of people saying this is just a liberal vendetta. Let's stick with the Roberts part for the moment. What can Roberts do? What power does he actually have here? And are other members of the court, either present or past, similarly culpable?
Well, as Chief Justice, he's known to be someone who cares a lot about the reputation of the court and is an institutionalist. And it's clear that this is putting a cloud over the court. So one suspects that he cares about the situation, but what can he do? He has said that he is considering and looking into and conferring with the justices about the possibility that they will agree to abide by the same ethics rules that the lower courts do. They've been looking at this for a number of years, though, and it doesn't seem that Chief Justice Roberts has made much progress on it.
In other words, there's no inclination on the part of Chief Justice Roberts to single out Justice Thomas in any way?
I think it's really unlikely. I mean, basically, the court has been described to me as 9 separate law firms. Each one of these justices has their own kind of law firm and confers among with its own clerks and people, and the harmony that exists on the court, to the extent that it has, is because no one really tells the others what to do. Again, it's the honor system at the Supreme Court. And if there is dishonor, there's really only one remedy that's ever been spelled out in the Constitution, and that's impeachment.
The drama of Clarence Thomas has been going on for a very long time. He was nominated to the court by George H.W. Bush. And of course, his confirmation hearings were unforgettable, and it seems like there's been a great deal of drama along the way, despite his relative silence, at least on the bench. Where is this story going? We've even heard time and again that his health is not the best, that he might retire. I think optimally he'd prefer to retire when there's a Republican in the presidency. Where is this story going for Clarence Thomas?
You know, I mean, it's hard to say, but Clarence Thomas has a history of being defiant in the face of criticism. In a way, it seems to embolden him to sort of double down. It is worth thinking about, though, how some in the modern era, there have been Supreme Court justices who have been forced off, or at least one, and that's Abe Fortas, who in 1969 was forced off of the Supreme Court because of revelations about his financial wheeling and dealings with a former client.
The Abe Fortas example, though, which is absolutely apt, is different, though, in kind, isn't it, from Clarence Thomas? Clarence Thomas, you know, he has got a friend. He just happens to be a billionaire. They, you know, his hospitality is glitzier than most, as opposed to financial wheelings and dealings to benefit the pocketbook of a justice.
Yes and no. I mean, the second story that ProPublica published was about a real estate deal involving Clarence Thomas and Harlan Crowe. Mm-hmm. It's a deal in which money went right into Clarence Thomas's pockets. He owned a house in Savannah, Georgia, and his mother was living in the house, mm-hmm. and they sold the house to Harlan Crowe. And so that money went to Clarence Thomas. And interestingly, Clarence Thomas's mother has been living in that house ever since. She still lives there today. I think she's 94 years old, rent-free, thanks to Harlan Crowe.
That seems even more egregious.
I think it's a very dangerous situation for Clarence Thomas, really. This is because there is a specific category of finance that has to be disclosed according to the 1978 mm-hmm. Ethics in Government Act, and it's real estate transactions over $1,000, and this one was for something like $133,000. There's really no way to argue that he shouldn't have disclosed this. He should have disclosed this. He has said it was an oversight, and that he didn't understand.
He just forgot.
That's what he said.
He's a Supreme Court justice, and he didn't understand the requirements. That seems to bend, if not break, credulity.
Yeah.
Jane, if it's true, and it seems that it is, that trust in the Supreme Court or the integrity of the court is getting lower all the time, what effect does that have on our political lives?
Oh, I think it's, you know, very dangerous for democracy. I mean, the glue that holds us together is the rule of law in this country. And people have to believe when they go in front of a court, and particularly in front of the Supreme Court, that they're getting a fair shake and that this isn't just politics, and that whether they are a Republican defendant or a Democratic one or whatever else, that they are, that it's justice that's going to prevail, not just partisan politics.
Jane Mayer is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and she's the co-author of the book Strange Justice. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Hello again, everybody. This is Peter Jennings in New York, and you were looking at the scene under a very cloudy and occasionally drizzly rainy day here in New York City. This is intended to be in New York and in Washington today, a national day of prayer and remembrance, which means, of course...
Just 3 days after 9/11, on a day when the nation was mourning the victims of those attacks, Congress passed a joint resolution of enormous gravity. In just 60 words, representatives gave to the president the power to use all necessary and appropriate force against whoever had perpetrated or aided the attack. And not only that, he could also use military force to prevent future attacks of international terrorism. The president could now make war without having to go back to Congress, which is what the Constitution had always demanded. The resolution was called the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, or AUMF. And it eventually brought our country to war with Iraq and was used to deploy American forces all over the world. The vote for AUMF in 2001 was unanimous, almost. In the entire House and the entire Senate, there was just one representative who voted no, Barbara Lee of California. What do you remember about that day? Describe the lead up to the vote and the reaction you got.
I always remember standing with Elijah Cummings in the cloakroom in the back of the House chamber, talking to Elijah, telling him how sad and how angry I was because of what had taken place, but how I knew that we had to respond appropriately. I, like everyone else in the country, were very sad and really grieving and thinking about Flight 93, because I was sitting in the Capitol and had to evacuate that morning. And my chief of staff's cousin, Wanda Green, was a flight attendant on that flight. And she, of course, as they took down that plane, which probably saved our lives, my life, she was killed. And so it was a very emotional moment for myself, but I had to...
I didn't know that. I'm sorry to hear that. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So we were personally... impacted by what had taken place. And Wanda was on that flight and I was in the Capitol, and, you know, as history shows, Flight 93 was probably coming into the Capitol, and Wanda and the flight attendants took that plane down. Mm. We had to respond appropriately, but this authorization that had been presented was only a 60-word authorization, which really was a blank check to give over congressional authority to any president to wage war. And I went to the memorial. I remember I was the last person getting on the bus. It was a very gloomy, rainy day. The dean of the National Cathedral gave his eulogy and his sermon. He said in it, "As we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore." it was at that moment I wrote that down on the program. And when we got back to the Capitol, then it was at that moment I was very settled about my no vote.
Mr. Speaker, members, I rise today really with a very heavy heart, one that is filled with sorrow for the families and the loved ones who were killed and injured this week. Only the most foolish and the most callous would not understand the grief that has really gripped our people and millions across the world. This unspeakable act on the United States has really forced me, however, to rely on my moral compass, my conscience, and my God for direction. September 11th changed the world. Our deepest fears now haunt us. Yet I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States. This is a very complex and complicated matter. However difficult this vote may be, some of us must urge the use of restraint. Some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control.
Now, fast forward to Iraq, which was the next year, that once again, President Bush wanted to use force. Embedded in that Iraq authorization was the 9/11 authorization too. So they used that as the basis to invade Iraq. Thousands of our troops, brave men and women, were killed. Some have lifelong injuries. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqi refugees, thousands of Iraqis killed, over $1 trillion misspent. It was a terrible, terrible moment in the history of this country. And that opened the door for ISIS and all of the other terrorist activities that we see all around the world now, including on the continent of Africa.
That's Barbara Lee talking with me about the authorization for the use of military force, the first of such measures, which took place in 2001. Congress passed another AUMF in 2002. And now, over 20 years later, officials in both houses are pushing to repeal it. The mood in the country has changed tremendously, and yet the timing here is worth looking at closely. A bill in the Senate to revoke AUMF passed 66-30 a few weeks ago, and that effort was led by Tim Kaine, a Virginia Democrat, and Todd Young, a Republican from Indiana. I spoke with them both last week. Senator Kaine, it's probably worth remembering that in 2001, Barbara Lee said, I don't think the president should have the authority to wage war. And for many members of Congress, and in the commentariat, I should also say, that put her patriotism in question. What does it say that that is no longer the case?
You know, look, if you can't learn some lessons after 20 years of war, shame on you. You know, I think that the 20 years of the war on terror and the war in Iraq, the repeated deployments, you know, when have we had a war where people deployed 6 or 7 times? That wasn't in World War II. You know, that wasn't in Korea. Vietnam, there were multiple deployments, but not 6 or 7 deployments. You do 6 or 7 deployments. What's your test case for what that means in the afterlife of somebody who served? What does that mean for the VA? What does that mean for divorce rates? What does it mean for a million things? And so I think we have learned some lessons. Let's also give Iraq credit. I mean, Iraq was an enemy. We toppled that government. We then departed Iraq, I think, in 2011. But then they asked us back in 2014 to help them defeat ISIS. And we are there at their continued invitation, both to deal with ISIS and also to help them check Iranian aggression. We've beaten the sword into a plowshare. A nation that was an enemy is now a partner. And we have to give credit to the magnanimity of Iraqis as well.
Well, but with a great, great deal of bloodshed in between.
Absolutely. But there is this thing in our history where the bloodshed of World War II, Japan and Germany are strong allies now. The bloodshed of the Vietnam War, Vietnam is getting closer and closer in our relationship. And if we send a message in like repealing the Iraq AUMF, this nation that was an enemy we're now strategic partners, then anybody who's an enemy of the United States can look at that and say, the U.S. doesn't have permanent enemies. The U.S. is always going to try to figure out a way to turn, you know, an enemy into a partner, and it's hard and it takes time and may or may not happen, but I think that's an important part of this.
Senator, you don't see that as a fairly sunny reading of the Iraq War?
Well, look, I do. It's a reality. There's 4,500 American troops were killed, tens of thousands of Americans were injured, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were killed. That's what haunts me about this. We did the 2002, the decision was made in 3 days, and it was rushed, and look what happened. Look at the human consequence of that. And yet, that's all a reality, and I'm haunted by it, that if the time had been taken, we might have avoided that and then avoided a lot of other challenges. And yet at the same time, I do think you have to acknowledge that the U.S. is working and Iraq is working to make a relationship that is a positive one. And in that positive relationship, maintaining a war authorization against Iraq is offensive, frankly insulting.
And dangerous, right? I mean, these are authorizations still on the book that could conceivably be used by a future commander-in-chief to re-engage us in various areas around the world. So we just can't allow that to stand.
Senator Young, was there a road to Damascus moment for you on this? What changed between 9/11 and 2023 that made you feel that now there's a turning point and the AUMF, second one, had outlived its use?
For me, you know, this really began when I served in the military. I attended the U.S. Naval Academy and spent 5 years in the U.S. Marine Corps. And though many smart people serve at the highest ranks in our military, you do get some insight into your leadership and recognize that they are fallible like anyone else. And so that was part of it. That shaped my perspective as I followed issues like engagement in the Iraq War. Then over a period of time, it became clear to me that Tim indicated, that this was a conflict we rushed into ill-advisedly. And I want to be critical, but not too critical of members who served during that time and who authorized the force in the wake of 9/11 and all the rest. But it was pretty clear to me, and frankly, clear to my constituents, clear to my neighbors, that we'd made a mistake, and it cost so many lives. It cost us treasure, and we just can't afford, especially in an era of strategic competition with China, we can't afford to make another mistake like this. And the American people need to be able to hold accountable those of us who are charged on their behalf with making these decisions. So it was a gradual process for me.
Now, Senator Young, you've both emphasized the bipartisan nature of this bill, but most of your Republican colleagues in the Senate are not necessarily with you. There are 49 Republicans in the Senate. 30 of them voted no and want to preserve the AUMF, as we were discussing. Even if you disagree with them, what's the sticking point for them? What are the politics within the Republican caucus, and what do you expect to see going forward?
So almost without exception, the stated objectives from some of my colleagues, and it's a principled objection, is that this could, by repealing the O2 Iraq Authority, somehow create an impression that the United States is withdrawing from the region. As Tim and I
from the Middle East. From
the Middle East,
yeah.
From Iraq in particular, and as we have repeatedly reminded our colleagues, Iran right now is engaged in misinformation campaigns against the sitting Iraqi government, which was just formed in January. We think and we believe, and this belief is shared by the sitting Iraqi government, that by repealing the 2002 AUMF, we send a message of solidarity with the people of Iraq and their government, and this demonstrates strength so that we can work together against threats to their peace and security posed by Iran and others.
Senator Kaine, we're now in a moment when there is a ground war taking place in Europe, the biggest ground war since the Second World War.
Right, yeah.
And unless I'm wrong, it seems to me that the politics of that war in Congress are in question, that the longer this war goes on, there's concern, certainly in Kyiv, that congressional support for that war will recede, that there will be an exhaustion among the American people, that the 2024 election will bring Ukraine into the debate. You've seen, for example, Governor DeSantis going back and forth, trying to find some sort of firm ground for himself on the war in Ukraine. How much does the politics of Ukraine have to do with what's going on now with AUMF, and how might it influence the future?
I still believe that, as a member of both Armed Services and Foreign Relations in the Senate, that there is a strong bipartisan and bicameral support in Congress for investing and supporting Ukraine until they win this very, very important battle, started without any provocation. And I think that the bipartisan support for Ukraine is very strong.
I agree.
There's two kinds of objection. It's strong, not unanimous. So there are folks here who, some for reasons of, fiscal reasons, and some because they don't view this, Ukraine necessarily as a core interest of the U.S. There's a small group of people who are not completely supportive. And then there's a second group that are raising legitimate questions. Are we investing the right way? Are we overseeing how the money is used to make sure it's really going to do what's intended? And all those questions are legitimate. I mean, we have to ask those questions. But I do think that it is still bipartisan, bicameral, strong support, and that's going to last through the election cycle and beyond. The consequences of Russia being able to do this without consequence are just too grave around the world. And I don't – it was interesting, as we were having the floor debate about the repeal of 02AUMF, we had the bill on the floor for 2 weeks. It was, four times longer than the declaration of war against Iraq. We had a lot of amendments, and there was opportunity for people to offer amendments dealing with Ukraine, but folks didn't. They offered amendments about Iran or Iran-backed militias, but the members of the Senate kind of kept Ukraine separate from this, and they understood that it is separate. And I think you're going to see the same thing on the House side. Probably on the House side, as they take up our AUMF repeal, there's a good bipartisan group of supporters there. There will probably be some discussions about Iran-related issues, but I don't think the Ukraine politics is going to kind of get into this and knock it sideways.
Senator Young, a final question, and it is striking the sense of bipartisanship, not only between the two of you, but in large measure in the Senate. But if Donald Trump were president now, what would the Republican support for this be? How deep does this bipartisanship go?
I think most of those in the Senate who supported the 2002 repeal would continue to support its repeal. Let's remember that President Trump campaigned on trying to end the forever wars. And, I will say, whatever one thinks of his presidency and his record, we did not become embroiled in military conflicts abroad. So this is consistent with the spirit of President Trump's stated foreign policy. But more importantly, it has broad-based support around the country. So I don't think the votes would change markedly.
Senator Todd Young, Senator Tim Kaine, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
That was Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia and Republican Senator Todd Young of Indiana. Earlier, we heard from Representative Barbara Lee of California, a Democrat. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Hanif Abdurraqib is a New Yorker contributor, and he's based in his hometown of Columbus, Ohio. He's a poet, an essayist, the author of a number of books largely about music. And like most true music lovers, Hanif is also a fan of the stuff around the music, the merch. He's got a huge collection of concert t-shirts, and he agreed to show me some of his favorites. So, Hanif, you've picked out some concert t-shirts and some music that kind of go together, and you're going to share them with us today. How big is this famous collection of tees?
I have 73 as of right now, but this weekend I have
73 tour shirts and one tie.
And one tie, yeah. I mean, truly, maybe not even one tie.
How did you get into getting vintage tour t-shirts?
You know, I'm fascinated by the kind of like wearable ephemera that is attached to music. I got when I was young, I was really into pins, you know, band pins from years and years and years ago. And then I was very into kind of backstage passes, which you can still buy online. I have a small collection of just backstage passes from bands and concerts. But the shirts are fascinating. The shirts really are fascinating to me because not only are they, and it's like a more extreme version of going to a thrift store. But yeah, I have 73 tour shirts this weekend. I'm going to an auction right down the road to bid on a couple other ones. So by the end of the weekend, I'll maybe have 75.
So what's your key source for this stuff? Is it eBay or something more specialized?
It started out on Etsy. Because Etsy dealers are a little more, you can find very specific, like this dealer has all the old hardcore punk shirts.
Right.
This dealer has old R&B shirts. But now I have like a, much like with my sneaker collection, I have like a person who sources these for me. Because otherwise I would,
I've got a guy.
Because otherwise I would spend all my time just like online doing this. And it's one of those things that I noticed was taking up so
productive.
Much of my time.
I don't care if you have a MacArthur. That wouldn't be productive. What is the first t-shirt we're talking about? And the first song that goes with it.
The first shirt is, I don't know if it's this one. This is a shirt of the band DeBarge, the singing group, the family group DeBarge. This is from their Rhythm of the Night tour. And so this shirt is like a teal blue kind of thing, and it has the band's name above a red square that they're all in. And the thing that I love about DeBarge in general, and that I love about this shirt, is that, you know, with DeBarge, these photos in the 80s, they all look dressed like they're all going out on a very different night on the town.
And there's a lot of big shoulders, a lot of primary colors in those suits,
huge primary colors, a lot of large pocket squares.
All right, let's hear a little music from DeBarge. What's the song?
The song is Rhythm of the Night, the great single that this shirt was based off of. The music video for this song is very delightful.
I can only imagine we are dancing on Zoom here. It all comes back. It all comes back. Okay, Hanif, next shirt.
Next shirt is this shirt from the Judds Farewell Tour, which is, you know, the Judds I love and adore. And this shirt is just kind of them in a blue square. Their name is in red. They're holding a guitar.
Very big hair. And it's a farewell tour. So you're getting the whole tour. You're getting the whole tour itinerary. Did you see the Judds when they were through?
I did not. No.
Too young.
No, I mean, during 99, in 91 when they came through, I was maybe 5 years old. No, 6 or 7 years old. So I was a little too young.
Knock it off. All right, let's hear the Judds. What are they singing?
They got Why Not Me, which is one of my favorite songs. I adore this song. It's both like a classic Judd song. It's both sad and a little sweet.
What does this song tell us about you, Hanif?
What I love about the Judds in general, but particularly Why Not Me, is so much of their music is steeped in kind of like longing and feeling on the outside of an emotion that they cannot get into, or the outside of an affection that they can't otherwise access. And I feel like that has... in some ways, that is a defining point of anguish for I think, like me and everyone in my circle. We all grew up like emo kids and punk kids who felt really outside of many things except for our own one or two really fluorescent feelings.
Like that. Next T-shirt.
All right. I have a shirt that is as old as me. Jimmy Cliff. From the Power and the Glory tour, 1984.
Ooh, I like that. How much you want for that?
This I could just send to you, in part because it no longer fits me. Jimmy Cliff on the front, Power and the Glory written across his head. And I adore this shirt. This is actually one of the first vintage tour shirts I ever got.
What are we going to hear from Jimmy Cliff?
Many Rivers to Cross, a classic.
There we go. I love that organ opening.
Yeah, it's perfect.
An incredible voice he had.
That intro, the organ to vocal intro is one of my favorite moments, and I think all of music maybe.
I'm really sorry I never got to see Jimmy Cliff. I don't think he's performing anymore.
Yeah, that's a dream.
It really is. It really is.
There's a handful of artists who I think I mourn the fact that I've missed them. And then when I listen to their music, it's like that mourning returns anew.
Who's in that group?
You know, a lot of it with me is folks that I was maybe old enough to go see, and I just didn't, you know, and then we lost them. Late era Johnny Cash. Phyllis Hyman, you know, I really love Phyllis Hyman. That's someone.
This is someone I miss. One inheritance I got from my dad. We didn't have much money, but he would take us to see music and musicians that I didn't think anything of at the time. And then I realized, oh my God, I got to see Louis Armstrong when I was 11, you know, or Dave Brubeck or Ella Fitzgerald. And it's a very lucky thing.
Yeah.
Hanif, thank you so much. Be well and good luck at the auction this weekend.
Thank you, David. I really appreciate it.
The New Yorker's Hanif Abdurraqib. He wrote for us recently on the great musical collective known as Chocolate Genius Incorporated. You can read that essay at newyorker.com.
Many rivers to cross, but I can't seem to find my way over.
Finally, I want to close on a personal note today about a recent loss that all of us at The New Yorker feel deeply. The cartoonist Ed Koren first started publishing in the magazine in 1962. That's before the Beatles showed up at Shea Stadium. And in his long tenure, first in New York, then in Vermont, Koren evolved into a defining voice of the magazine, what we all would hope to be, humane, progressive, funny, decent. His status-anxious subjects, whether they were portrayed as jittery human beings or woolly Koren creatures, we're always struggling with a way to live in the world, a world that's filled with doubt, strangeness, and absurdity. There are countless ways an artist or a satirist can approach the madness. Ed's sensibility, his way of being in the world, was to heighten the decency within him. And he brought it out in his readers, too. The cartoon editor Emma Allen, as well as writers like Mark Singer and Calvin Trillin, were in frequent touch with Ed to the end. They all knew he was sick. Ed made no pretense about it. And yet, even as his voice weakened, you left those conversations filled with a sense not only of a life well lived, but of someone radiating a sense of hope.
The quote that I come back to often, the secret source, it's Mark Twain. The secret source of humor is sorrow. And I think that encapsulates it for me beautifully.
Not so long ago, Ed spoke with Christopher Lydon of Radio Open Source at his home in Vermont. And he talked about his work for many years on the volunteer fire department in the town of Brookfield.
Well, that was one way of reaching out and getting to know what this town is like and where this huge social disparity exists, but which disappears when we have a common task. And it's kind of symbolic in a way, because we don't talk politics, mercifully. We don't talk about anything other than the fire, the incident, or a wreck, which is oftentimes the case. People from other places speeding to the slopes through our patch of the woods here. So it's very, illuminates me and my life as much as anything else.
Does it feed your cartoons?
Well, to a degree, in that I see the huge social gulfs between people and how they live. Because one of the things you do as a member of the fire department, you interact with all kinds of people in all kinds of situations, all kinds of homes, kinds of ways of life, all kinds of reactions. There's gratitude, there's bother, there's irritation. There's all sorts of human behavior that I use in ways that I can't tell you. Picture that interacting with my love of, say, Tintoretto or of Carpaccio, Vittorio Carpaccio. It's a wonderful, wonderful artist. And picture that with my love of George Herriman and Crazy Cat. And picture that with my love of Daumier. And on and on.
The late and wonderful Ed Koren. You can hear a longer version of that conversation at radioopensource.org. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening to the program today. I hope you'll join us next time.
Well, here's one that I think is really germane to our situation. This one. The woman scrubbing a toilet. And there's a kind of visual setup, a little camera on a tripod. And she's pleased as punch with joy. And she's saying to her husband and small daughter, I've just started scrubbing the toilet and I already have 27,000 views.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Toon Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Brita Green, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, Avery Keatley, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keithline, Michael May, David Gable, and Meher Bhatia. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.